dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has been studying closely for quite some time now, both with the United States government's Defense Department, with the RAND Corporation, and at a splendid institute, the National Institute for Public Policy, as well as in his present role as a professor at the University of Texas, San Antonio, its Department of International Security Studies. His name is Dr. Brad Thayer, and he has recently published a book by him and his colleague John Friend entitled How China Sees the World, Han Centrism and the Balance of Power in International Politics. I'm extremely pleased to say that Dr. Thayer is one of the members of this new Committee on the Present Danger China that I am associated with as well, and we're extraordinarily appreciative of the expertise that he brings to the job of warning the American people about the present danger posed by what you call Han centrism. Dr. Thayer, welcome. It's so good to have you.
Frank, thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, the pleasure is ours. Let's talk first and foremost about Han centrism, a term that I must say I haven't heard before. Perhaps you've coined it, but explain why you think it's the best way to describe the impetus behind what the Chinese Communist Party is up to at the moment.
Certainly. I argue that that China is a threat to the United States because of its capabilities, but also because of its intent. Its intent is informed by its grand strategy, and its grand strategy is heavily colored by its nationalism, Han centrism, the belief that the Han, the majority of the Chinese people, 91% approximately of the Chinese people, are distinct individuals. They are a distinct nation, and that's quite common of all nationalism. But what makes Han centrism particularly dangerous is that the Chinese go further. It is a supremacist nationalism, which believes that they are the best and that all other nations and states should be subordinate to them. So what we're witnessing really with China's rise is not only the prodigious growth of capabilities, which you've documented so well, of course, for so many years, but also that their intent is becoming far more malign in recent years and has become essentially egregious under Xi Jinping. And that's heavily informed by the hyper-nationalist belief of Han centrism.
Let me drill down on that for a moment, because this is really such a critical point. And we, as I said a moment ago, build this program as an intelligence briefing on what I call the war for the free world. Intelligence, historically, has focused, when it's done properly at least, on capabilities rather than on intentions. Because, as you know, Dr. Thayer, so well, capabilities don't change generally overnight. Intentions can. So talk a little bit, if you would, first of all, about this idea that has been, well, I guess the French would call it an idée fixe, an absolute, unshakable truth to most China hands for the past 30 or 40 years, namely that this rise of China, as you put it, would be peaceful, and that what would come out of it at the other end was perhaps a trade competitor, but essentially another member in good standing of the international community, a status quo power, and a partner with us for peace.
Yes, indeed. That still is a very common belief among, as you know, of course, in Washington and beyond. However, I think that view is wrong. And I think that view is wrong for two reasons. One, it fundamentally underestimates the Chinese and the power of nationalism in international politics and in China itself. The Chinese, the Han, believe that they are distinct and that they are superior. and that it is right and proper that they dominate international politics. For the Chinese, that's the return to normalcy. It's the return to the way international politics as they knew it existed before they went through the misfortune of from the first Opium War in 1839 and after of being colonized. And then, of course, what they call the century of humiliation.
The rather bad patch that they ran into, a break in what was otherwise several thousand years of pretty extraordinary power and development. And so just so we're clear, Dr. Thayer, what you've described here clearly antedates considerably the period of Xi Jinping's rule. I want to come back to him, but just give us a little bit of the historical flavor of how far back does this kind of supremacist nationalism go in China?
It goes back into a deep Chinese history. It is certainly to about the Warring States period of by about 220 BC. The Chinese imperial government was defined by essentially ruling in the name of the Han and for the Han, right? That was the emperor had the mandate of heaven, of course, a very important concept in Chinese political thought, as long as he was serving his people, the Han. And so this belief, the idea of the Han nation, and its supremacy. The Han have produced the most advanced civilization in the world. They even believe, some of them, the more radical elements, that they're evolutionarily different from other humans. And so when we drill down on this concept, it becomes very worrisome, right? We recognize that the Chinese see themselves as unique and superior, part of the same family, but superior to all others. And of course, they have a very clear hierarchy, really, and it's informed by racial elements as well. So we're witnessing the return of bad ideas here, really bad ideas to international politics with China's rise.
Bad and ominous, in other words. To the extent that there's been something of a debate, and I'm not quite clear where the truth lies, but perhaps you can tell us where at least you come down on it, that this is partly, at least, a desire to supplant what's been called the Westphalian order, going back some 300 years, where nation states and their sovereignty were sort of the fundamental building blocks of an international order. Is China talking about dispensing with that and having all nations essentially as vassal states or simply no longer as states at all under a new sort of imperial China?
I would say the Chinese are determined to replace the international order that the British and the Americans created after World War II. The Westphalian aspect is a bit complicated because the Chinese are very supportive of sovereignty, which comes, of course, out of the Peace of Westphalia in 1648. But they also have a very strong conception of hierarchy, and they're at the top, and everyone else is below, which is anti-Westphalia, right, which recognize a community of nations, a community of sovereign, equal states. So this is a very dangerous idea.
Hold the thought, if you would. We're going to be talking about this dangerous idea in practice with Dr. Bradley Thayer right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say, with the author of an important book, How China Sees the World, Han Centrism and the Balance of Power in International Politics. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. His co-author is John Friend. They have put forward, as we've just been discussing, a thesis that there is a sort of underlying agenda that is born of a conviction of the supremacy of the Han people and their determination to achieve their rightful place in the world, which is dominating it. And anyone, including the United States of America, had best get out of the way and just get accustomed to submitting to it. Let's talk about what's this historic sort of tradition, if you will, or mindset, Dr. Thayer, and bring it into the communist era, maybe starting with Mao Zedong. What were his practices with respect to Han centrism?
Well, formally, he as a good communist, obviously, he attempted to suppress nationalism, but he also recognized its power. So he did so occasionally, but by and large, Mao was supportive of the Han identity as well. So it's very difficult to separate, either at the mass level or at the elite level, decision makers in China. It's very difficult to essentially prize out that nationalist component from them, even when you're dealing with communists, right? Even when you're dealing with a very powerfully anti-nationalist ideology like communism is, which says, of course, that we should unite around class, or in Mao's case, obviously, the peasantry. So even Mao used it. And when you turn to the modern era, let's say post-Mao Deng Xiaoping, and then contemporary Xi Jinping, we see that nationalism is a very powerful tool for establishing the party's legitimacy. You would have nationalism anyway, but after Tiananmen, right, Deng recognizes that Han-centric appeals are just even a more powerful tool to shore up the legitimacy of the party in the wake of that very dangerous time in Chinese political history after the massacre in June 1989 in Tiananmen Square. So you see Deng fostering it.
Appealing, in other words, to this sort of DNA, I guess one might say, of the Chinese Han people to pull them in despite the unpopularity of the regime. May I ask just a question that I guess I should have posed in the previous segment, but let me tease it out with you here. Is this racist fundamentally as well as nationalist, would you say?
Well, I believe at a fundamental level it is, because the Han-centric idea has racial components associated with it, and that the Chinese belief structure sees darker-skinned people in particular, those with darker complexions, as being inferior. So we do see with this pernicious belief, Han-centrism, that racism and eugenicist ideas also heavily inform the worldview of China. And that, again, it marks the return of bad and very dangerous ideas to international politics.
We're going to come back to this in a minute, but I did want to just say in the context of this, if I may, that what China is doing in Africa in terms of the debt trap of the Belt and Road Initiative clearly would be informed, if not driven by that racist attitude towards dark-skinned people, would it not?
It would be. The Chinese are exploitative of everybody, but their business practices are heavily informed by that as well. And we should expect, as we have seen countless times for decades now, their experiences in South Asia or in Africa is defined by the exploitation of the natural environment, but also the exploitation of people. As well, and that's legitimized by the Chinese in this Han-centric framework in their belief system. It's right and proper. Anything that advances China, anything that's good for the Han, is legitimate.
Let me turn to the sort of intermezzo here of Deng Xiaoping. You touched on him a moment ago, but he's perhaps best known, as you understand far better than I, Dr. Thayer, by his phrase, hide and bide, at least an English paraphrase of it, that suggested he was going to be building the capacity for a not-so-peaceful rise by obscuring the true intentions of the Chinese government and this Han-centrist agenda. How did he do that? And how was it that we fell for it, I guess is the question.
Well, I believe we fell for it because we were ignorant of it. We simply weren't paying attention to what was happening in terms of the belief structure. And as you observed at the outset, the common belief held by business communities in the United States and in the West broadly, as well as governmental officials in the West broadly, was that when China interacted, if you will, with the Western economic ecosystem, if you will, that would cause them to evolve. And they would become more like a Western country. But that grossly underestimates Chinese identity and the determination of the Chinese to overthrow the international order that exists presently.
And that abides long after Deng Xiaoping has left the scene, to some extent, at least in the circles. And this is what's so important and why I prize particularly what you and your colleagues represent, especially in academia. Bradley Thayer, is, you know, a much more clear-eyed approach to what the Chinese are doing. It's especially astonishing that given the degree to which, as you sort of suggested a moment ago, Xi Jinping is letting the mask slip. This is no longer Deng's hide and bide. This is now more and more brazenly aggressive, is it not? The same, I guess, Han-centrist program as has been present throughout, but now becoming less and less obscured by rhetoric or, for that matter, some of the practices they've engaged in.
Indeed. With near the end of Hu, certainly, but with Xi Jinping, you really see a leader who is determined to bring China to dominance as rapidly as possible. So he's an individual who proudly marches at pride of place in the Imperial Pride Parade, right? He's out there saying that this is the China dream. China will be the dominant state, certainly by the centenary of the Chinese Communist Revolution that would be 2049, obviously, if not long before. And as you know, and you've documented so well, they have envisioned for what we'll accomplish by 2025 and 2035. So we've been very slow in recognizing that, clearly.
Well, let's, again, explain what you're talking about there, this dangerous decade, some have called it. What's in prospect if Xi has his way, if his China dream is realized in, you know, 2025 to 2035, leading up to 2049?
Well, that is the dispositive question of the 21st century, right? Whether Western civilization and whether the international order that the United States created with its allies can be sustained, or whether we'll witness the return of authoritarianism as the dominant strain of international politics. So the Chinese are determined to remake international order economically, that is, in the near term, working within Western institutions, while at the same time, in the longer term, creating institutions to supplant the WTO, for example. In the political sphere, right, we're seeing the triumph of the Beijing consensus in international politics. The Chinese are advancing the idea that you can become a modern state. The future is authoritarianism. Authoritarianism is the right political structure to have wedded to hyper-capitalism. So you can be rich and secure if you're a dictator, for example, in international politics. In the military realm, obviously, they're striving for dominance, to be able to push us out of the Indo-Pacific and then beyond and dominate. They're driving, as you know, for technological leadership. So this determination ultimately is rooted, we argue, in that Han conception, the belief that the Chinese are best, they're superior, their dominance is good for everybody in their own mind. And we're lucky to live in the world that they're creating, right? That's kind of the solipsistic view, which is completely detached from reality and from recognizing the complexities and the stability provided by the present international order.
But having said all of that, it still can be an ambition that they nonetheless aggressively seek to realize, and we ignore that that is their agenda at our extreme peril. Hey, before we start, again, getting into some of the particulars here, just in the closing minute or so for this block, Dr. Bradley Thayer, would you just explain the role that the Chinese Communist Party plays in all of these endeavors and the furtherance of the China dream?
Well, they take a bad situation and make it worse, and that is that the Han-centric beliefs would be present without the Chinese Communist Party, but the Chinese Communist Party need legitimacy. They are fundamentally an illegitimate polity in China. And so making nationalistic appeals talking about the greatness of the Chinese people, the greatness of the Han, talking about the China dream that China is laboring, obviously, under Xi to return China to its right and proper place, which is the dominant state in international politics, demonstrating the superiority of Chinese civilization. Again, this is a very dangerous situation, but the party needs it. They need to make these nationalistic appeals, and so that makes them even more dangerous.
Brad, we have to pause for just a second. We're going to be right back with more with Dr. Bradley Thayer of the University of Texas, San Antonio, and we're going to talk about the particular relationship between the People's Liberation Army and a Chinese Communist Party that is now clearly becoming more and more aggressive and more an enemy of this country. That and much more straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are discussing with the author of an important book published last year entitled How China Sees the World, Han Centrism and the Balance of Power in International Politics. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is a professor of international security studies in Texas, the University of Texas, San Antonio specifically. He has co-authored this book with John Friend. And we're discussing some of the insights that it is providing us about both the ideological, if you will, or cultural, I called it DNA a moment ago, impetus behind the ever-increasing aggressiveness under Xi Jinping of Communist China. I want to repeat that Brad Thayer is a member of a founding member of the new Committee on the Present Danger China, which just had a very important event this week and its rollout 2 weeks ago, videos of which can be found at presentdangerchina.org. We were talking before the break, Bradley Thayer, about the degree to which the Chinese Communist Party is really the driving force behind sort of translating this Han centrism into a sort of agenda for control at home and aggressiveness abroad. Would you just give us a sense of where does the People's Liberation Army, or PLA as it's known, fit into this? What's its relationship to the party versus the government of China more generally?
Well, Frank, of course, as you know, the party it dominates everything. And so the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, is an arm of the Communist Party of China. And that's very important for communists. It goes back to the Leninist vision of how communist states should be governed. And as Mao recognized, of course, the importance of the PLA, that power comes out of the barrel of the gun, and the PLA is the barrel from which power flows. So it's absolutely essential. And the Communist Party ensures that the People's Liberation Army is under its complete control, which is, means under Xi's control.
Right. And party commissars and all of that to enforce it. But the loyalty institutionally is to the party, not to the state, not to the people of China.
Right. So very unlike the American system or Western systems of civil military organization. However, they are, as being good, as good communists, they're very aware of it and very sensitive to political warfare, which they have been waging against us for a very long time. But the good news is, from our perspective, of course, is that Han centrism provides many important values and essentially asymmetries that the United States and its allies can capitalize upon as well, that China's imperious nature and exploitative policies provide the United States with the opportunity to reach out to the global community to first illustrate this, call attention to it, and then say, of course, everyone who has an investment in free markets, in being treated fairly, in being considered equally, the principles, the political principles, values, and norms of the present international order has an interest in supporting the United States.
Right. This is a point I want to come back to, Brett, in our concluding segment in a moment. But just, again, to further explicate what we are confronting now, the present danger, as we call it, describe for us this concept of SHI, S-H-I, as it bears on the agenda and the implementation of it through the Communist Party's agenda, that is, through its foreign policy at the moment.
Yes. It's a very important concept in Chinese strategic thought. And the idea is a Xi, or sometimes pronounced Shur, the idea is that the strategist should labor to take small events, as the Chinese metaphorically describe it, as upstream, so that the effect could be exaggerated downstream. So small measures taken will have, in the longer term, profound effects. So small measures in undermining U.S. alliances, in securing natural resources, in securing straits, many of the steps that we witnessed, right, that the Chinese have already taken, are informed by this strategic idea. And the expectation is these small measures were not noticed by the United States in the South China Sea or in the control of ports, obviously, the belt, aspects of the Belt and Road Initiative, et cetera.
Or if noticed, I think it's fair to say, not opposed. That's kind of the crux of the matter.
Frank, I think that's exactly right. But we're not opposed because they were small steps.
And the same sort of mindset that we were discussing earlier, Dr. Thayer, about, you know, oh, it's all the peaceful rise of China, and as long as we're trading with them and investing in them and so on, it won't matter. It'll all come out right, which the Chinese, of course, exploited to the hilt.
Indeed, they did. It was supreme folly. It was really the biggest grand strategic mistake the United States ever made was fostering the economic growth of China.
Fostering and enabling it, really. Would you just, you know, there was a very interesting comment made by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich at our event on Tuesday. And again, people can find his comments in full and the rest of the program, for that matter, at presentdangerchina.org. And I really commend it to you. He talked about the importance of studying the Chinese game of Go. Again, most of us are not even familiar with it, but just describe how that is sort of a training vehicle for people who think strategically, think about multiple steps on a board, and this concept of Xi as it fits into that.
Well, yes, absolutely. We in the West, we usually study chess, right? We grew up playing it, and still that maintains a passion for many of us. But that's about direct conquest. You're going out directly engaging your opponent, taking his pieces, and then maneuvering him to defeat. Well, the Chinese game of Go is essentially inspired by the idea of this strategic idea, sure, which is that what you're going to do is maneuver your opponent, taking small steps in the near term to essentially cause his defeat. It's a game which involves being able to think through multiple steps and ensure and embraces deception so that the opponent is not able to see, unlike chess, what you're doing. And so that's heavily informed. And again, it's quite natural that the Chinese have developed this because that's a large pillar of their approach to strategy.
Right. So when you look at what the Chinese are now doing, they've clearly laid out a multifaceted program for achieving world dominance. And you've mentioned a number of ways in which this has been done. Others are talked about in our videos from the launch event at presentdangerchina.org. But one of the pieces of this that I think you've mentioned and that is almost entirely, well, misunderstood or not recognized by Americans is, as you put it, that the Chinese have been waging political warfare against this country for decades. And indeed, they've been waging economic warfare against this country, I would argue, for decades. And now there's the prospect that they will be waging the old-fashioned kinetic kind in the not-too-distant future. How is it, Dr. Thayer, that a country like ours, which prides itself on having the best intelligence services in the world, could have so completely failed to understand what's going on here. You mentioned small steps, and you mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of wishful thinking and so on, but surely the intelligence professionals, often described as sort of omniscient gods monitoring all things, couldn't have missed all of these warning signs, could they? Let alone the war that's been going on against us.
Indeed. I would have to say at the end of the day, in baseball, it's either a win or a loss, right? Or a W or an L. The intelligence community, I think, got many pieces. But at the end of the day, it was an L. It was a loss. We were slow to illuminate this, I think, for first because of reasons that the Chinese took, expertly disguising their steps, but even sometimes, as you observed, right, overtly. But when they acted through an economic guise, with an economic cover, which resonated, I think, with many of our intelligence figures. Well, that's simply natural, they might say. The Chinese are expanding economically, and there's no harm or foul involved in that. They're essentially engaged in free trade, and if you're engaged in free trade, you're going to be peaceful. I think, secondly, the next big part of it were not only the steps that the Chinese took to do this, but also the way we were distracted. I think there are two elements here. One, we were distracted because of the, it seemed, ultimately pernicious influence of Fukuyama's argument, first advanced in 1980, Francis Fukuyama, the political scientist, first advanced in 1989, then 1992, of the end of history. The belief that with the end of the defeat of the Soviet Union, we understood what worked. That was liberal democracy and capitalism.
Yeah, we won.
Yeah, we won. And there's now we don't have to worry about great power competition. And we can take a holiday. A second element of that, too, was 9/11. And so a consequence of 9/11 was to distract the United States strategic community to deal with the threat of Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, Frank, as you well documented for decades. And the cost of that was, as we know, bureaucracies can focus typically on a few things.
Or maybe one.
Yes, and the global terrorist threat, which we did.
Brad, is it just that they took advantage of it, or were they actually in various ways enabling the distractedness of this country by working with some of the, Sharia supremacists, I call them, that were preoccupying us at the time?
I believe that they were doing everything they could to ensure that we were distracted. It would ultimately be fruitless. The Chinese obviously back Iran. Clearly. So, you know, they have been involved in this, if you will, a bit obliquely, but nonetheless involved in this.
Brad, we have to pause for one last time. We're going to be right back with Dr. Bradley Thayer right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are visiting for this full hour, the final segment of which is at hand, alas, with the co-author of How China Sees the World, Han Centrism and the Balance of Power in International Politics. He is Dr. Bradley Thayer. The book is dedicated to a friend of both of ours, Andrew Marshall, an extraordinary human being and great national security practitioner who recently passed, I'm sorry to say. And thank you for that tribute to a great American. Let me turn to what Andy Marshall would probably argue needs to be done about this present danger, Bradley Thayer. You enumerate in your book six particularly important ideas or advantages that we can exploit in some cases or things that we could do to disadvantage the Chinese. And the first is by countering the Chinese influence in what you call the global south, by going back to what we talked about in the first segment, exposing the racism and the culture that flows from Han centrism, to point it out to people who are currently having other reasons for chafing under Chinese domination.
Absolutely. And that would be, Mr. Marshall was always very sensitive to taking advantage of the opportunities your opponent gives you. And the Chinese have given us a significant number of opportunities. And this is one of them, simply to point out that the fruits of their ideology, the fruits of their Han centrism, are very deleterious for everyone else in international politics. And it's very important that we convey that message to those who may be ignorant of it or who may be allies, present allies of the Chinese. It's very important for peoples in those countries to call attention or to query their leaders about why is it that we're aligning with this state, which has a supremacist ideology at the end of the day.
Right. And a racist one at that. So arguing that the Chinese business practices are destructive is another one of your key points. That would seem to be increasingly easy to do, especially as we talk about the Belt and Road Initiative's, well, I call it payday loans, but the debt trap that is it operating in it. And more generally, what's happened to American businesses investing in China or aspiring to tap into that market? Walk us through that, if you would.
Absolutely. Frank, as you know, it's opaque, right? Chinese banking, the Chinese financial sector, at the end of the day, is opaque. We do not know. And would it be wise to invest in that? Well, it strikes me, obviously, and many others, that you really don't know the financial health of Chinese business concerns or of banking. But the point, clear, more and more individuals in the American, obviously, financial community or abroad are recognizing this. Sri Lanka has recognized that it got itself into the debt trap and is trying to get out of it. Even in Pakistan, a very close, one of China's few very close allies, is recognizing that the relationship that they've gotten into with the Chinese is, to say at a minimum, problematic. And they need to find a way to maintain their sovereignty in the face of a China, which is essentially going to compel control, which will dominate Pakistan at economically and politically.
Yeah. And in terms of expropriating strategic assets, some of which the Chinese are building on this debt trap model, Belt and Road Initiative, but some of which they've simply taken over because they're valuable in places like Djibouti and the like. So you've mentioned as a third item, we sort of touched on it already, the bad record of China on racial equality. I guess that has implications beyond the global South, does it not?
It does indeed. The West went through a civil rights movement, right? We established very strong cultures of anti-racism in Western societies. It's unthinkable that the Chinese would do that, right? That simply doesn't enter their consciousness that you should treat people with different racial backgrounds equally. At some level, it's absurd for the Chinese worldview. So that gives us another very powerful advantage. We have a great quote in the book from a Zambian politician who said, explaining really the consequences of interacting with China. He said, "We had bad people before. The whites were bad. The Indians were worse, but the Chinese are worst of all." Right. And that is in terms of their racial attitudes and in terms of their just raw exploitative approach to their business dealings and personal dealings.
Yeah, I guess it's the contempt on top of everything else that is particularly galling as you're being exploited. A fourth of your priorities for us is the simple fact that the United States, Washington, if you will, is a vastly more appropriate, suitable, beneficial partner for political and economic development. I think it's compared to what? Some have faulted us over the years, of course, but compared to the Chinese, it's not even a close call, is it?
It's not even a close call. That's exactly right. We are an open society, using the framework or the metrics that the famous philosopher of science Karl Popper identified. That we allow, there's economic freedom, there's political freedom, civil rights are respected. We went free. We have transformed our societies. Right? Western societies, when they make mistakes, can correct them. There's no even inclination in China that they would go through any type of movement with respect to women's rights or with respect to the rights of ethnic minorities in China. And in fact, we're seeing the reverse. As you well know, And as you've documented, of course, on Tuesday, you had that excellent presentation from the Uyghur American, who talked about the exploitation and the suppression and the concentration camps that the Chinese now for Kazakhs and for Uyghurs in Xinjiang. And that's just standard operating procedure. They did the same thing in Tibet, and these steps are ongoing. So will China ever go through a civil rights movement? No, China will never go through.
Certainly, most especially for people who are not part of China. I mean, minorities are obviously second-class citizens, but the rest of the world is going to find itself third or fourth or fifth class. So this really, I think, subsumes the fifth point, which is that we're a better society. We're a better model for other societies to participate in and develop into, but we're not.
Indeed. They can engage in our society, again, as we are an open society. When we make mistakes, we correct them. And you'll have a far better relationship with the United States and with Western civilization more broadly.
Yeah. Brings me to one point, Bradley, that I want to just quickly cover because its ominousness is hard to overstate. And that is the prospect that the Chinese are going to be introducing around the world the kind of surveillance state apparatus and techniques and capabilities that are making possible the so-called social credit score in China. Talk a little bit about that and the implications for societies worldwide.
Well, it is very pernicious, as you observed. There is no conception of individual freedom, of civil rights, of the value of the individual. That's greatly diminished, obviously. It is not a Western conception, right? It's not a Western polity. So what are we going to witness? Well, we're going to witness that the Chinese are giving and are giving to authoritarian states the tools to maintain their authoritarianism and to make it ever more effective. And we can witness that, of course, in international politics and their support in Myanmar or their support in Zimbabwe or elsewhere. We can also recognize how they're trying to influence American politics and politics in the Western world more broadly. And you're doing that through essentially an all-azimuth approach.
Which means everything, I guess, from this kind of authoritarian model and technology and 5G and influence operations on campuses and elsewhere. It's really staggering. And I did want to reserve just a minute for the final point, if I could, Brad, there. America is inclusive, not exclusive, is a critical advantage for us, is it not? And how would that play into this calculation as you see it?
If you're fair and you're looking at the world honestly, the United States and the West broadly offers a far better society. It's one that broadly welcomes immigration. It allows individuals to come from around the world to achieve tremendous success in a stable polity, which respects individual rights and the rights of all members of the society, and that is able to bring about changes. Positive changes within their societies. The Chinese are the reverse of all of that. They are closed. They are exclusionary.
They are indeed. We have to leave it at that. Bradley Thayer, there is, well, an awful lot more to talk with you about, but I'm so appreciative that you've given us this time to visit about how China sees the world. Come back soon. I hope the rest of you will come back tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.